was at hand. The chorus of "Cut him! Cut him!" grew louder, like Romans chanting for the gladiators to kill and kill. "We're almost there, Amiraho! Almost there!" Hassan was panting. Then the moment came. I closed my eyes and loosened my grip on the string. It sliced my fingers again as the wind dragged it. And then, I didn't need to hear the crowd's roar to know. I didn't need to see either. Hassan was screaming, and his arm was wrapped around my neck. "Bravo! Bravo, Amiraho!" I opened my eyes and saw the blue kite spinning wildly like a tire come loose from a speeding car. I blinked and tried to say something, but nothing came out. Suddenly, I was hovering, looking down on myself from above. Black leather coat, red scarf, faded jeans. A thin boy, a little sallow, and a tad short for his 12 years. He had narrow shoulders and a hint of dark circles around his pale, hazel eyes. The breeze rustled his light brown hair. He looked up to me, and we smiled at each other. Then I was screaming, and everything was color and sound, and everything was alive and good. I was throwing my free arm around Hassan, and we were hopping up and down, both of us laughing, both of us weeping. "You won, Amiraho! You won! We won! We won!" was all I could say. This wasn't happening. In a moment, I'd blink and rouse from this beautiful dream, get out of bed and march down to the kitchen to eat breakfast with no one to talk to but Hassan. Get dressed and wait for Baba. Give up. Back to my old life. Then, I saw Baba on our roof. He was standing on the edge, pumping both of his fists, hollering and clapping. And that, right there, was the single greatest moment of my 12 years of life. Seeing Baba on that roof, proud of me at last. But he was doing something now, motioning with his hands in an urgent way. Then I understood. "Hassan, I know," he said, breaking our embrace. "Inshallah, we'll celebrate later. Right now, I'm going to run that blue kite for you," he said. He dropped the spool and took off running, the hem of his green chapan dragging in the snow behind him. "Hassan," I called, "come back with it." He was already turning the street corner, his rubber boots kicking up snow. He stopped and turned. He cupped his hands around his mouth. "For you, 1,000 times over, he said. Then he smiled his Hassan smile and disappeared around the corner. The next time I saw him smile unabashedly like that was 26 years later in a faded Polaroid photograph. I began to pull my kite back as people rushed to congratulate me. I shook hands with them and said my thanks. The younger kids looked at me with an awestruck twinkle in their eyes. I was a hero. Hands patted my back and tousled my hair. I pulled on the string and returned every smile, but my mind was on the blue kite. Finally, I had my kite in hand. I wrapped the loose string that had collected at my feet around the spool and shook a few more hands and trotted home. When I reached the wrought iron gates, Ali was waiting on the other side. He stuck his hand through the bars. "Congratulations," he said. I gave him my kite and spool and shook his hand. "Tashakkur, Ali John. I was praying for you the whole time." "Then keep praying, we're not done yet," I said. I hurried back to the street. I didn't ask Ali about Baba, I didn't want to see him yet. In my head, I had it all planned. I'd make a grand entrance, a hero, prize trophy in my bloodied hands. Heads would turn and eyes would lock. Rustam and Sohrab sizing each other up. A dramatic moment of silence. Then the old warrior would walk to the younger one, embrace him, acknowledge his worthiness. Vindication, salvation, and redemption. And then? Well, happily ever after, of course. What else? The streets of Wazir Akbar Khan were numbered and set at right angles to each other like a grid. It was a new neighborhood then, still developing, with empty lots of land and half-constructed homes on every street between compounds surrounded by 8-foot walls. I ran up and down every street looking for Hassan. Everywhere people were busy folding chairs, packing food and utensils after a long day of partying. Some, still sitting on their rooftops, shouted their congratulations to me. 4 streets south of ours, I saw Omar, the son of an engineer who was a friend of Baba's. He was dribbling a soccer ball with his brother on the front lawn of their house. Omar was a pretty good guy. We'd been classmates in 4th grade, and one time he'd given me a fountain pen, the kind you had to load with the cartridge. "Hey, I heard you won, Amir," he said. "Congratulations." "Thanks. Have you seen Hassan? Your Hazara?" he said. I nodded. Omar headed the ball back to his brother. "Hey, I hear he's an amazing kite runner," he said. His brother headed the ball back to him. Omar caught it and tossed it up and down. "Although, I've always wondered how he manages. I mean, with those tight little eyes, how does he see anything?" His brother laughed, a short burst, and asked for the ball. Omar ignored him. "Well, have you seen him?" I asked. Omar flicked a thumb over his shoulder, pointing southwest. "I saw him running toward the bazaar a while ago." "Thanks," I said, and scuttled away. By the time I reached the marketplace, the sun had almost sunk behind the hills, and dusk had painted the sky pink and purple. A few blocks away from the Haji Yaqub Mosque, the mullah bellowed azan, calling for the faithful to unroll their rugs and bow their heads west in prayer. Hassan never missed any of the 5 daily prayers. Even when we were out playing, he'd excuse himself, draw water from the well in the yard, wash up, and disappear into the hut. He'd come out a few minutes later, smiling, and find me sitting against a wall or perched on a tree. He was going to miss prayer tonight, though, because of me. The bazaar was emptying quickly, the merchants finishing up their haggling for the day. I trotted in the mud between rows of closely packed cubicles where you could buy a freshly slaughtered pheasant in one stand and a calculator from the adjacent one. I picked my way through the dwindling crowd, the lame beggars dressed in layers of tattered rags, the vendors with rugs on their shoulders, the cloth merchants and butchers closing shop for the day. I found no sign of Hassan. I stopped by a dried fruit stand and described Hassan to an old merchant loading his mule with crates of pine seeds and raisins. He wore a powder blue turban. He paused to look at me for a long time before answering. "I might have seen him." "Which way did he go?" I asked. He eyed me up and down. "What is a boy like you doing here at this time of the day looking for a Hazara?" His glance lingered admiringly on my leather coat and my jeans. Cowboy pants, we used to call them. In Afghanistan, owning anything American, especially if it wasn't secondhand, was a sign of wealth. "I need to find him, Agha," I said. "What is he to you?" I didn't see the point of his question, but I reminded myself that impatience wasn't going to make him tell me any faster. "He's our servant's son," I said. The old man raised a paper gray eyebrow. "He is? Oh, lucky Hazara, having such a concerned master. Maybe his father should get on his knees and sweep the dust at your feet with his eyelashes. Are you going to tell me or not?" He rested an arm on the mule's back and pointed south. "I think I saw the boy you described running that way. He had a kite in his hand, a blue one." "He did?" I said. "For you, 1,000 times over," he promised. "Good old Hassan. Good old reliable Hassan. He'd kept his promise and run the last kite for me." "Of course, they've probably caught him by now," the old merchant said, grunting and loading another box on the mule's back. "Who?" "The other boys," he said. "The ones chasing him. They were dressed like you." He glanced to the sky and sighed. "Now run along. You're making me late for namaz." But I was already scrambling down the lane. For the next few minutes, I scoured the bazaar in vain. Maybe the old merchant's eyes had betrayed him, except it seemed a blue kite. The thought of getting my hands on that kite, I poked my head behind every lane, every shop. No sign of Hassan. I had begun to worry that darkness would fall before I found Hassan when I heard voices from up ahead. I'd reached a secluded, muddy road. It ran perpendicular to the end of the main thoroughfare, bisecting the bazaar. I turned onto the rutted track and followed the voices. My boots squished in mud with every step, and my breath puffed out in white clouds before me. The narrow path ran parallel on one side to a snow-filled ravine through which a stream may have tumbled in the spring. To my other side stood rows of snow-burdened cypress trees peppered among flat-topped clay houses, no more than mud shacks in most cases, separated by narrow alleys. I heard the voices again, louder this time, coming from one of the alleys. I crept closer to the mouth of the alley and held my breath, peeked around the corner. Hassan was standing at the blind end of the alley in a defiant stance, fists curled, legs slightly apart. Behind him, sitting on piles of scrap and rubble, was the blue kite, my key to Baba's heart. Blocking Hassan's way out of the alley were three boys, the same three from that day on the hill, the day after Daoud Khan's coup, when Hassan had saved us with his slingshot. Wali was standing on one side, Kamal on the other, and in the middle, Asif. I felt my body clench up, and something cold rippled up my spine. Asif seemed relaxed, confident. He was twirling his brass knuckles. The other two guys shifted nervously on their feet, looking from Asif to Hassan, like they'd cornered some kind of wild animal that only Asif could tame. "Where's your slingshot, Hazara?" Asif said, turning the brass knuckles in his hand. "What was it you said?" "They'll have to call you One-Eyed Asif." "That's right, One-Eyed Asif. Well, that was clever, really clever." "Then again, it's easy to be clever when you're holding a loaded weapon." I realized I still hadn't breathed out. I exhaled slowly, quietly. I felt paralyzed. I watched them close in on the boy I'd grown up with, the boy whose hair-lipped face had been my first memory. "But today is your lucky day, Hazara," Asif said. He had his back to me, but I would have bet he was grinning. "I'm in a mood to forgive. What do you say to that, boys?" "That's generous," Kamal blurted, "especially after the rude manners you showed us last time." He was trying to sound like Asif, except there was a tremor in his voice. Then I understood. He wasn't afraid of Hassan, not really. He was afraid because he had no idea what Asif had in mind. Asif waved a dismissive hand. "Bakshida, forgiven, it's done." His voice dropped a little. "Of course, nothing is free in this world, and my pardon comes with a small price." "That's fair," Kamal said. "Nothing is free," Wali added. "You're a lucky Hazara," Asif said, taking a step toward Hassan. "Because today, it's only going to cost you that blue kite. A fair deal, boys, isn't it?" "More than fair," Kamal said. Even from where I was standing, I could see the fear creeping into Hassan's eyes, but he shook his head. "Amir Agha won the tournament, and I ran this kite for him. I ran it fairly. This is his kite." "A loyal Hazara, loyal as a dog," Asif said. Kamal's laugh was a shrill, nervous sound. "But before you sacrifice yourself for him, think about this. Would he do the same for you? Have you ever wondered why he never includes you in games when he has guests? Why he only plays with you and no one else is around? I'll tell you why, Hazara. Because to him, you're nothing but an ugly pet. Something he can play with when he's bored. Something he can kick when he's angry. Don't ever fool yourself and think you're something more." "Amir Agha and I are friends," Hassan said. He looked flushed. "Friends?" Asif said, laughing. "You pathetic fool. Someday you'll wake up from your little fantasy and learn just how good of a friend he is. Now, Bas, enough of this. Give us the kite." Hassan stooped and picked up a rock. Asif flinched. He began to take a step back and stopped. "Last chance, Hazara." Hassan's answer was to cock the arm that held the rock. "Whatever you wish," Asif said. Asif unbuttoned his winter coat and took it off. He folded it slowly and deliberately. He placed it against the wall. I opened my mouth and almost said something. Almost. The rest of my life might have turned out differently if I had, but I didn't. I just watched, paralyzed. Osef motioned with his hand, and the other two boys separated, forming a half circle, trapping Hassan in the alley. "I've changed my mind," Osef said. "I'm letting you keep the kite, Hazara. I'll let you keep it so it will always remind you of what I'm about to do." Then he charged. Hassan hurled a rock. It struck Osef in the forehead. Osef yelped as he flung himself at Hassan, knocking him to the ground. Wali and Kamal followed. I bit on my fist and shut my eyes. A memory. "Did you know Hassan and you fed from the same breast? Did you know that, Amir Agha?" Sakina, her name was. She was a fair, blue-eyed Hazara woman from Bamiyan, and she sang you old wedding songs. They say there's a brotherhood between people who fed from the same breast. Did you know that? A memory. "A rupiah each, children. Just 1 rupiah each, and I will part the curtain of truth." The old man sits against the mud wall. His sightless eyes are like molten silver embedded in deep twin craters. Hunched over his cane, the fortune teller runs a gnarled hand across the surface of his deflated cheeks. He cups it before us. "Not much to ask for the truth, is it? 1 rupiah each?" Hassan drops a coin in the leathery palm. "I drop mine too." "In the name of Allah, most beneficent and most merciful," the old fortune teller whispers. He takes Hassan's hand first and strokes the palm with one horn-like fingernail, round and round, round and round. The finger then floats to Hassan's face and makes a dry, scratchy sound as it slowly traces the curve of his cheeks, the outline of his ears. The callous pads of his fingers brush against Hassan's eyes. The hand stops there, lingers. A shadow passes across the old man's face. Hassan and I exchange a glance. The old man takes Hassan's hand and puts the rupiah back in Hassan's palm. He turns to me. "How about you, young friend?" he says. On the other side of the wall, a rooster crows. The old man reaches for my hand, and I withdraw it. A dream. I'm lost in a snowstorm. The wind shrieks and blows stinging sheets of snow into my eyes. I stagger through layers of shifting white. I call for help, but the wind drowns my cries. I fall and lie panting on the snow, lost in the white. I watch the snow erase my fresh footprints. I'm a ghost now, I think. A ghost with no footprints. I cry out again, hope fading like my footprints. But this time, a muffled reply. I shield my eyes and manage to sit up. Out of the swaying curtains of snow, I catch a glimpse of movement, a flurry of color. A familiar shape materializes. A hand reaches out for me. I see deep parallel gashes across the palm, blood dripping and staining the snow. I take the hand, and suddenly the snow is gone. We're standing in a field of apple-green grass, with soft billows of clouds drifting above. I look up and see the clear skies filled with kites, green and yellow, red and orange. They shimmer in the afternoon light. A havoc of scrap and rubble littered the alley. Worn bicycle tires and bottles with peeled labels. Ripped up magazines and yellowed newspapers all scattered amid a pile of bricks and slabs of cement. A rusted cast iron stove with a gaping hole on its side tilted against a wall. But there were two things amid the garbage that I couldn't stop looking at. One was the blue kite resting against the wall close to the cast iron stove. The other was Hassan's brown corduroy pants thrown on a heap of eroded bricks. I don't know, Wali was saying. My father says it's sinful. He sounded unsure, excited, scared, all at the same time. Hassan lay with his chest pinned to the ground. Kamal and Wali each gripped an arm, twisted and bent at the elbow so that Hassan's hands were pressed to his back. Asif was standing over them, the heel of his snow boots crushing the back of Hassan's neck. "Your father won't find out," Asif said. "And there's nothing sinful about teaching a lesson to a disrespectful donkey." "I don't know," Wali muttered. "Suit yourself," Asif said. He turned to Kamal. "What about you?" It's just a Hazara," Asif said. But Kamal kept looking away. "Fine," Asif snapped. "All I want you weaklings to do is hold him down. Can you manage that?" Wali and Kamal nodded. They looked relieved. Asif knelt behind Hassan and put his hands on Hassan's hips and lifted his bare buttocks. He kept one hand on Hassan's back and undid his own belt buckle with his free hand. He unzipped his jeans and dropped his underwear. He positioned himself behind Hassan. Hassan didn't struggle. He didn't even whimper. He moved his head slightly and I caught a glimpse of his face. I saw the resignation in it. It was a look I'd seen before. It was the look of the lamb. Tomorrow is the 10th day of Dhul Hijjah, the last month of the Muslim calendar, and the first of 3 days of Eid al-Adha, or Eid al-Qurban as Afghans call it, a day to celebrate how the Prophet Ibrahim almost sacrificed his own son for God. Baba has handpicked a sheep again this year, a powder white one with crooked black ears. We all stand in the backyard, Hassan, Ali, Baba and I. The mullah recites the prayer and rubs his beard. Baba mutters, "Get on with it," under his breath. He sounds annoyed with the endless praying, the ritual of making the meat halal. Baba mocks the story behind this Eid, like he mocks everything religious. But he respects the tradition of Eid al-Qurban. The custom is to divide the meat in thirds, one for the family, one for friends, and one for the poor. Every year, Baba gives it all to the poor. "The rich are fat enough already," he says. The mullah finishes the prayer. Ameen. He picks up the kitchen knife with the long blade. The custom is to not let the sheep see the knife. Ali feeds the animal a cube of sugar. Another custom, to make death sweeter. The sheep kicks, but not much. The mullah grabs it under its jaw and places the blade on its neck. Just a second before he slices the throat in one expert motion, I see the sheep's eyes. It's a look that will haunt my dreams for weeks. I don't know why I watch this yearly ritual in our backyard. My nightmares persist long after the bloodstains on the grass have faded. But I always watch. I watch because of that look of acceptance in the animal's eyes. Absurdly, I imagine the animal understands. I imagine the animal sees that its imminent demise is for a higher purpose. This is the look. I stopped watching and turned away from the alley. Something warm was running down my wrist. I blinked and saw I was still biting down on my fist, hard enough to draw blood from the knuckles. I realized something else. I was weeping. From just around the corner, I could hear Asif's quick rhythmic grunts. I had one last chance to make a decision, one final opportunity to decide who I was going to be. I could step into the alley and stand up for Hassan, the way he'd stood up for me all those times in the past, and accept whatever would happen to me. Or I could run. In the end, I ran. I ran because I was a coward. I was afraid of Asif and what he would do to me. I was afraid of getting hurt. That's what I told myself as I turned my back to the alley, to Hassan. That's what I made myself believe. I actually aspired to cowardice. Because the alternative, the real reason I was running, was that Asif was right. Nothing was free in this world. Maybe Hassan was the price I had to pay, the lamb I had to slay to win Baba. Was it a fair price? The answer floated to my conscious mind before I could thwart it. He was just a Hazara, wasn't he? I ran back the way I'd come. I ran back to the all but deserted bazaar. I lurched to a cubicle and leaned against the padlocked swing doors. I stood there panting and sweating, wishing things had turned out some other way. About 15 minutes later, I heard voices and running footfalls. I crouched behind the cubicle and watched Asif and the other two sprinting by, laughing as they hurried down the deserted lane. I forced myself to wait 10 more minutes. Then I walked back to the rutted track that ran along the snow-filled ravine. I squinted in the dimming light and spotted Hassan walking slowly toward me. I met him by a leafless birch tree on the edge of the ravine. He had the blue kite in his hands. That was the first thing I saw. And I can't lie now and say my eyes didn't scan it for any rips. His chapan had mud smudges down the front, and his shirt was ripped just below the collar. He stopped, swayed on his feet like he was going to collapse. Then he steadied himself, handed me the kite. "Where were you? I looked for you," I said. Speaking those words was like chewing on a rock. Hassan dragged a sleeve across his face and wiped snot and tears. I waited for him to say something, but we just stood there in silence, in the fading light. I was grateful for the early evening shadows that fell on Hassan's face and concealed mine. I was glad I didn't have to return his gaze. Did he know I knew? And if he knew, then what would I see if I did look into his eyes? Blame? Indignation? Or, God forbid, what I feared most, guileless devotion? That, most of all, I couldn't bear to see. He began to say something, and his voice cracked. He closed his mouth, opened it, and closed it again. He took a step back, wiped his face, and that was as close as Hassan and I ever came to discussing what had happened in the alley. I thought he might burst into tears, but to my relief he didn't, and I pretended I hadn't heard the crack in his voice, just like I pretended I hadn't seen the dark stain in the seat of his pants, or those tiny drops that fell from between his legs and stained the snow black. "Arasai will worry," was all he said. He turned from me and limped away. It happened just the way I'd imagined. I opened the door to the smoky study and stepped in. Baba and Rahim Khan were drinking tea and listening to the news crackling on the radio. Their heads turned. Then a smile played on my father's lips. He opened his arms. I put the kite down and walked into his thick, hairy arms. I buried my face in the warmth of his chest and wept. Baba held me close to him, rocking me back and forth. In his arms, I forgot what I'd done, and that was good. For a week, I barely saw Hassan. I woke up to find toasted bread, brewed tea, and a boiled egg already on the kitchen table. My clothes for the day were ironed and folded, left on the cane seat chair in the foyer where Hassan usually did his ironing. He used to wait for me to sit at the breakfast table before he started ironing. That way we could talk. He used to sing, too, over the hissing of the iron, sang old Hazara songs about tulip fields. Now only the folded clothes greeted me. That and a breakfast I hardly finished anymore. One overcast morning, as I was pushing the boiled egg around on my plate, Ali walked in cradling a pile of chopped wood. I asked him where Hassan was. "He went back to sleep," Ali said, kneeling before the stove. He pulled the little square door open. "Would Hassan be able to play today?" Ali paused with the log in his hand. A worried look crossed his face. Lately, it seems all he wants to do is sleep. He does his chores, I see to that. But then he just wants to crawl under his blanket. "Can I ask you something?" he said. "If you have to." After that kite tournament, he came home a little bloodied and his shirt was torn. I asked him what had happened and he said it was nothing, that he'd gotten into a little scuffle with some kids over the kite. I didn't say anything. Just kept pushing the egg around on my plate. "Did something happen to him, Amiroha? Something he's not telling me?" I shrugged. "How should I know? You would tell me, nay? Inshallah, you would tell me if something had happened." "Like I said, how should I know what's wrong with him?" I snapped. "Maybe he's sick. People get sick all the time, Ali. Now, am I going to freeze to death? Or are you planning on lighting the stove today?" That night, I asked Baba if we could go to Jalalabad on Friday. He was rocking on the leather swivel chair behind his desk, reading an Iranian newspaper. He put it down and took off the reading glasses I disliked so much. Baba wasn't old, not at all, and he had lots of years left to live. So why did he have to wear the stupid glasses? "Why not?" he said. Lately, Baba agreed to everything I asked. Not only that, just two nights before, he'd asked me if I wanted to see El Cid with Charlton Heston at Cinema Ariana. "Do you want to ask Hassan to come along to Jalalabad?" Why did Baba have to spoil it like that? "Oh, he's Mariz," I said, not feeling well. "Really?" Baba stopped rocking in his chair. "What's wrong with him?" I gave a shrug and sank in the sofa by the fireplace. "He's got a cold or something. Ali says he's sleeping it off." "I haven't seen much of Hassan the last few days," Baba said. "That's all it is then? A cold?" I couldn't help hating the way his brow furrowed with worry. "Just a cold. So, are we going Friday, Baba?" "Yes, yes," Baba said, pushing away from the desk. "Too bad about Hassan. I thought he might have had more fun if he came." "Well, the two of us can have fun together," I said. Baba smiled and winked. "Dress warm," he said. It should have been just the two of us. That was the way I wanted it. But by Wednesday night, Baba had managed to invite another 24 people. He called his cousin Humayun, who was actually Baba's second cousin, and mentioned he was going to Jalalabad on Friday. And Humayun, who had studied engineering in France and had a house in Jalalabad, said he'd love to have everyone over. He'd bring the kids, his two wives, and while he was at it, cousin Shafiqa and her family were visiting from Herat. Maybe she'd like to tag along, and since she was staying with cousin Nader in Kabul, his family would have to be invited as well, even though Humayun and Nader had a bit of a feud going. And if Nader was invited, surely his brother Farooq had to be asked too, or his feelings would be hurt, and he might not invite them to his daughter's wedding next month. And we filled three vans. I rode with Baba, Rahim Khan, and Kaka Humayun. Baba had taught me at a young age to call any older male Kaka or uncle, and any older female Khala or aunt. Kaka Humayun's two wives rode with us too. The pinch-faced older one with the warts on her hands, and the younger one who always smelled of perfume and danced with her eyes closed, as did Kaka Humayun's twin girls. I sat in the back row, carsick and dizzy, sandwiched between the 7-year-old twins who kept reaching over my lap to slap at each other. The road to Jalalabad is a 2-hour trek through mountain roads winding along a steep drop, and my stomach lurched with each hairpin turn. Everyone in the van was talking loudly and at the same time, nearly shrieking, which is how Afghans talk. I asked one of the twins, Fazila or Karima, I could never tell which was which, if she'd trade her window seat with me so I could get fresh air on account of my car sickness. She stuck her tongue out and said no. I told her that was fine, but I couldn't be held accountable for vomiting on her new dress. A minute later, I was leaning out the window. I watched the cratered road rise and fall, whirl its tail around the mountainside, counted the multicolored lorries packed with squatting men lumbering past. I tried closing my eyes, letting the wind slap at my cheeks. I opened my mouth to swallow the clean air. I still didn't feel better. A finger poked me in the side. It was Fazla, or Karima. What? I said. I was just telling everyone about the tournament, Baba said from behind the wheel. Kaka Humayun and his two wives were smiling at me from the middle row of seats. There must have been, what, 100 kites in the sky that day? Baba said. Is that about right, Amir?
I guess so, I mumbled.
100 kites, Humayun John, no laugh. And the only one still flying at the end of the day was Amir's. He has the last kite at home, a beautiful blue kite. Hassan and Amir ran it together. Congratulations, Kaka Humayun said. His first wife, the one with the warts, clapped her hands. Wah wah, Amir John, we're so proud of you, she said. The younger wife joined in. Then they were all clapping, yelping their praises, and telling me how proud I'd made them all. Only Rahim Khan, sitting in the passenger seat next to Baba, was silent. He was looking at me in an odd way. Please pull over, Baba, I said. What? Getting sick, I muttered, leaning across the seat, pressing against Kaka Humayun's daughters. Fazla or Karima's face twisted. Pull over, Kaka, his face is yellow. I don't want him throwing up on my new dress, she squealed. Baba began to pull over, but I didn't make it. A few minutes later, I was sitting on a rock on the side of the road as they aired out the van. Baba was smoking with Kaka Humayun, who was telling Fazla or Karima to stop crying. He'd buy her another dress in Jalalabad. I closed my eyes and turned my face to the sun. Little shapes formed behind my eyelids, like hands playing shadows on the wall. They twisted, merged, formed a single image. Hassan's brown corduroy pants, discarded on a pile of old bricks in the alley. Kaka Humayun's white two-story house in Jalalabad had a balcony overlooking a large walled garden with apple and persimmon trees. There were hedges that, in the summer, the garden shaped like animals, and a swimming pool with emerald-colored tiles. I sat on the edge of the pool, empty save for a layer of slushy snow at the bottom, feet dangling in. Kaka Humayun's kids were playing hide-and-seek at the other end of the yard. The women were cooking, and I could smell onions frying already, could hear the fit-fit of a pressure cooker, music, laughter. Baba, Rahim Khan, Kaka Humayun, and Kaka Nader were sitting on the balcony, smoking. Kaka Humayun was telling them he'd brought the projector along to show his slides of France. 10 years since he'd returned from Paris, and he was still showing those stupid slides. It shouldn't have felt this way. Baba and I were finally friends. We'd gone to the zoo a few days before and seen Marjan the lion, and I had hurled a pebble at the bear when no one was watching. We'd gone to Dad Khoda's kebab house afterward, across from Cinema Park, and had lamb kebab with freshly baked naan from the tandoor. Baba told me stories of his travels to India and Russia, the people he had met, like the armless, legless couple in Bombay who'd been married 47 years and raised 11 children. That should have been fun, spending a day like that with Baba, hearing his stories. I finally had what I had wanted all those years. Except now that I had it, I felt as empty as this unkempt pool I was dangling my legs into. The wives and daughters served dinner, rice, kofta, and chicken korma at sundown. We dined the traditional way, sitting on cushions around the room, tablecloth spread on the floor, eating with our hands in groups of four or five from common platters. I wasn't hungry, but sat down to eat anyway with Baba, Kaka Farooq, and Kaka Humayun's two boys. Baba, who'd had a few scotches before dinner, was still ranting about the kite tournament, how I'd outlasted them all, how I'd come home with the last kite. His booming voice dominated the room. People raised their heads from their platter, called out their congratulations. Kaka Farooq patted my back with his clean hand. I felt like sticking a knife in my eye. Later, well past midnight,
After a few hours of poker between Baba and his cousins, the men lay down to sleep on parallel mattresses in the same room where we'd dined. The women went upstairs. An hour later, I still couldn't sleep. I kept tossing and turning as my relatives grunted, sighed, and snored in their sleep. I sat up. A wedge of moonlight streamed in through the window. "I watched Hassan get raped," I said to no one. Baba stirred in his sleep. Kaka Homayun grunted. A part of me was hoping someone would wake up and hear, so I wouldn't have to live with this lie anymore. But no one woke up, and in the silence that followed, I understood the nature of my new curse. I was going to get away with it. I thought about Hassan's dream, the one about us swimming in the lake. "There's no monster," he'd said, "just water." Except he'd been wrong about that. There was a monster in the lake. It had grabbed Hassan by the ankles and dragged him to the murky bottom. I was that monster. That was the night I became an insomniac. I didn't speak to Hassan until the middle of the next week. I had just half eaten my lunch and Hassan was doing the dishes. I was walking upstairs, going to my room, when Hassan asked if I wanted to hike up the hill. I said I was tired. Hassan looked tired too. He'd lost weight and gray circles had formed under his puffed up eyes. But when he asked again, I reluctantly agreed. We trekked up the hill, our boots squishing in the muddy snow. Neither one of us said anything. We sat under a pomegranate tree, and I knew I'd made a mistake. I shouldn't have come up the hill. The words I had carved on the tree trunk with Ali's kitchen knife, "Amir and Hassan, the sultans of Kabul," I couldn't stand looking at them now. He asked me to read to him from the Shahnameh, and I told him I'd changed my mind. I told him I just wanted to go back to my room. He looked away and shrugged. We walked back down the way we'd gone up, in silence. And for the first time in my life, I couldn't wait for spring. My memory of the rest of that winter of 1975 is pretty hazy. I remember I was fairly happy when Baba was home. We'd eat together, go see a film, visit Kaka Humayun or Kaka Farooq. Sometimes Rahim Khan came over, and Baba let me sit in his study and sip tea with them. He'd even had me read some of my stories. It was good, and I even believed it would last. And Baba believed it too, I think. We both should have known better. For at least a few months after the kite tournament, Baba and I immersed ourselves in a sweet illusion and saw each other in a way that we never had before and never would again. We'd actually deceived ourselves into thinking that a toy made of tissue paper, glue, and bamboo could somehow close the chasm between us. But when Baba was out, and he was out a lot, I closed myself in my room. I read a book every couple of days, wrote stories, learned to draw horses. I'd hear Hassan shuffling around the kitchen in the morning, hear the clinking of silverware and the whistle of the teapot. I'd wait to hear the door shut, and only then I would walk down to eat. On my calendar, I circled the date of the first day of school and began a countdown. To my dismay, Hassan kept trying to rekindle things between us. I remember the last time. I was in my room, reading an abbreviated Farsi translation of Ivanhoe, when he knocked on my door. "What is it?" "I'm going to the baker to buy naan," he said from the other side. "I was wondering if you wanted to come along." "I think I'm just going to read," I said, rubbing my temples. Lately, every time Hassan was around, I was getting a headache. "It's a sunny day," he said. "Yeah, I can see that." "Might be fun to go for a walk," he said. "You go. I wish you'd come along." He paused. Something thumped against the door, maybe his forehead. "I don't know what I've done, Amir Agha. I wish you'd tell me. I don't know why we don't play anymore." "You haven't done anything, Hassan. Just go. You can tell me, I'll stop doing it, he said. I buried my head in my lap and squeezed my temples with my knees like a vice. I'll tell you what I want you to stop doing, I said, eyes pressed shut. Anything. I want you to stop harassing me, I said. I want you to go away. I wished he would give it right back to me, break the door open and tell me off. It would have made things easier, better. But he didn't do anything like that, and when I opened the door minutes later, he wasn't there. I fell on my bed, buried my head under the pillow, and cried. Hassan milled about the periphery of my life after that. I made sure our paths crossed as little as possible and planned my day that way. Because when he was around, the oxygen seeped out of the room. My chest tightened and I couldn't draw enough air. I'd stand there, gasping in my own little airless bubble of atmosphere. But even when he wasn't around, he was. He was there in the hand-washed and ironed clothes on the cane seat chair, in the warm slippers left outside my door, in the wood already burning in the stove when I came down for breakfast. Everywhere I turned, I saw signs of his loyalty, his goddamn unwavering loyalty. Early that spring, a few days before the new school year started, Baba and I were planting tulips in the garden. Most of the snow had melted, and the hills in the north were already dotted with patches of green grass. It was a cool gray morning, and Baba was squatting next to me, digging the soil and planting the bulbs I handed to him. He was telling me how most people thought it was better to plant tulips in the fall, and how that wasn't true, when I came right out and said it. Baba, have you ever thought about getting new servants? He dropped the tulip bulb and buried the trowel in the dirt. Took off his gardening gloves. That startled him. Chi? What did you say? I was just wondering, that's all, I said. Why would I ever want to do that? Baba said curtly. You wouldn't, I guess. It was just a question, I said, my voice fading to a murmur. I was already sorry I'd said it. Is this about you and Hassan? I know there's something going on between you two, but wherever it is, you have to deal with it, not me. I'm staying out of it. I'm sorry, Baba. He put on his gloves again. I grew up with Ali, he said through clenched teeth. My father took him in. He loved Ali like his own son. 40 years Ali's been with my family. 40 goddamn years. And you think I'm just going to throw him out? He turned to me now, his face as red as a tulip. I've never laid a hand on you, Amir. But if you ever say that again... He looked away, shaking his head. You bring me shame, he said. And Hassan? Hassan's not going anywhere. Do you understand? I looked down and picked up a fistful of cool soil, let it pour between my fingers. I said, do you understand? Baba roared. I flinched. Yes, Baba. Hassan's not going anywhere, Baba snapped. He dug a new hole with the trowel, striking the dirt harder than he had to. He's staying right here with us, where he belongs. This is his home, and we're his family. Don't you ever ask me that question again. I won't, Baba, I'm sorry. We planted the rest of the tulips in silence. I was relieved when school started that next week. Students with new notebooks and sharpened pencils in hand ambled about the courtyard, kicking up dust, chatting in groups and waiting for the class captain's whistles. Baba drove down the dirt lane that led to the entrance of the school. The school was an old two-story building with broken windows and dim cobblestone hallways, patches of its original dull yellow paint still showing between sloughing chunks of plaster. Most of the boys walked to school, and Baba's black Mustang drew more than one envious look. I should have been beaming with pride when he dropped me off. The old me would have. But all I could muster was a mild form of embarrassment. That, and emptiness. Baba drove away without saying goodbye. I bypassed the customary comparing of kite-fighting scars and stood in line. The bell rang and we marched to our assigned class, filed in pairs. I sat in the back row. As the Farsi teacher handed out our textbooks, I prayed for a heavy load of homework. School gave me an excuse to stay in my room for long hours. And for a while, it took my mind off what had happened that winter, what I had let happen. For a few weeks, I preoccupied myself with gravity and momentum, atoms and cells, the Anglo-Afghan wars, instead of thinking about Hassan and what had happened to him. But always, my mind returned to the alley, to Hassan's brown corduroy pants lying on the bricks, to the droplets of blood staining the snow dark red, almost black. One sluggish, hazy afternoon early that summer, I asked Hassan to go up the hill with me. I told him I wanted to read him a new story I'd written. He was hanging clothes to dry in the yard, and I saw his eagerness in the harried way he finished the job. We climbed the hill, making small talk. He asked about school, what I was learning, and I talked about my teachers, especially the mean math teacher who punished talkative students by sticking a metal rod between their fingers and then squeezing them together. Hassan winced at that and said he hoped I'd never have to experience it. I said I'd been lucky so far, knowing that luck had nothing to do with it. I had done my share of talking in class too, but my father was rich and everyone knew him, so I was spared the metal rod treatment. We sat against the low cemetery wall under the shade thrown by the pomegranate tree. In another month or two, crops of scorched yellow weed would blanket the hillside, but that year the spring showers had lasted longer than usual, nudging their way into early summer, and the grass was still green, peppered with tangles of wildflowers. Below us, Wazir Akbar Khan's white-walled, flat-topped houses gleamed in the sunshine, the laundry hanging on clotheslines in their yards stirred by the breeze to dance like butterflies. We had picked a dozen pomegranates from the tree. I unfolded the story I'd brought along, turned to the first page, then put it down. I stood up and picked up an overripe pomegranate that had fallen to the ground. "What will you do if I hit you with this?" I said, tossing the fruit up and down. Hassan's smile wilted. He looked older than I'd remembered. No, not older. Old. Was that possible? Lines had etched into his tanned face and creases framed his eyes and his mouth. I might as well have taken a knife and carved those lines myself. "What will you do?" I repeated. The color fell from his face. Next to him, the stapled pages of the story I'd promised to read him fluttered in the breeze. I hurled the pomegranate at him. It struck him in the chest and exploded in a spray of red pulp. Hassan's cry was pregnant with surprise and pain. "Hit me back," I snapped. Hassan looked from the stain on his chest to me. "Get up, hit me," I said. Hassan did get up, but he just stood there looking dazed, like a man dragged into the ocean by a riptide when, just a moment ago, he was enjoying a nice stroll on the beach. I hit him with another pomegranate, in the shoulder this time. The juice splattered his face. "Hit me back," I spat. "Hit me back, goddamn you!" I wished he would. I wished he'd give me the punishment I craved, so maybe I'd finally sleep at night. Maybe then things would return to how they used to be between us. But Hassan did nothing, as I pelted him again and again. "You're a coward," I said. "Nothing but a goddamn coward." I don't know how many times I hit him. All I know is that when I finally stopped, exhausted and panting, Hassan was smeared in red like he'd been shot by a firing squad. I fell to my knees, tired, spent, frustrated. Then Hassan did pick up a pomegranate, walked toward me. He opened it and crushed it against his own forehead. "There," he croaked, red dripping down his face like blood. "Are you satisfied? Do you feel better?" He turned around and started down the hill. I let the tears break free and rocked back and forth on my knees. "What am I going to do with you, Hassan? What am I going to do with you?" But by the time the tears dried up and I trudged down the hill, I knew the answer to that question. I turned 13 that summer of 1976, Afghanistan's next to last summer of peace and anonymity. Things between Baba and me were already cooling off again. I think what started it was the comment I'd made that day when we were planting tulips about getting new servants. I regretted saying it, I really did, but I think even if I hadn't, our happy little interlude would have come to an end. Maybe not quite so soon, but it would have. By the end of the summer, the scraping of spoon and fork against the plate had replaced dinner table chatter, and Baba had resumed retreating to his study after supper and closing the door. I'd gone back to thumbing through Hafez and Khayyam, gnawing my nails down to the cuticles and writing stories. I kept the stories in a stack under my bed, keeping them just in case, though I doubted Baba would ever again ask me to read them to him. Baba's motto about throwing parties was this: invite the whole world, or it's not a party. I remember scanning over the invitation list a week before my birthday party and not recognizing at least three-quarters of the 400-plus kakas and khalas who were going to bring me gifts and congratulate me for having lived to 13. Then I realized they weren't really coming for me. It was my birthday, but I knew who the real star of the show was. For days, the house was teeming with Baba's hired help. There was Salahuddin, the butcher, who showed up with a calf and two sheep in tow and refusing payment for any of the three. He slaughtered the animals himself in the yard by a poplar tree. "Blood is good for the tree," I remember him saying, as the grass around the poplar soaked red. Men I didn't know climbed the oak trees with coils of small electric bulbs and meters of extension cords. Others set up dozens of tables in the yard and spread a tablecloth on each. The night before the big party, Baba's friend, Del Muhammad, who owned a kebab house in Shahr-e-Now, came to the house with bags of spices. Like the butcher, Del Muhammad, or Delo as Baba called him, refused payments for his services. He said Baba had done enough for his family already. It was Rahim Khan who whispered to me, as Delo marinated the meat, that Baba had lent Delo the money to open his restaurant. Baba had refused repayment until Delo had shown up one day in our driveway in a Mercedes-Benz and insisted he wouldn't leave until Baba took his money. I guess in most ways, or at least in the ways in which parties are judged, my birthday bash was a huge success. I'd never seen the house so packed. Guests with drinks in hand were chatting in the hallways, smoking on the stairs and leaning against doorways. They sat where they found space, on kitchen counters, in the foyer, even under the stairwell. In the backyard, they mingled under the glow of blue, red, and green lights winking in the trees, their faces illuminated by the light of kerosene torches propped everywhere. Baba had had a stage built on a balcony that overlooked the garden and planted speakers throughout the yard. Ahmed Zahir was playing an accordion and singing on the stage over masses of dancing bodies. I had to greet each of the guests personally. Baba made sure of that. No one was going to gossip the next day about how he had raised a son with no manners. I kissed hundreds of cheeks and hugged total strangers and thanked them for their gifts. My face ached from the strain of my plastered smile. I was standing with Baba in the yard near the bar when someone said, "Happy birthday, Amir." It was Asif, with his parents. Asif's father, Mahmoud, was a short, lanky sort with dark skin and a narrow face. His mother, Tanya, was a small, nervous woman who smiled and blinked a lot. Asif was standing between the two of them now, grinning, looming over both, his arms resting on their shoulders. He led them toward us, like he had brought them here, like he was the parent and they his children. A wave of dizziness rushed through me. Baba thanked them for coming. "I picked out your present myself," Asif said. Tanya's face twitched, and her eyes flicked from Asif to me. She smiled unconvincingly and blinked. I wondered if Baba had noticed. "Still playing soccer, Asif John?" Baba said. He'd always wanted me to be friends with Asif. Asif smiled. It was creepy how genuinely sweet he made it look. "Of course, Kaka John." "Right wing, as I recall," Baba said. Actually, I switched to center forward this year, Osef replied. You get to score more that way. We're playing the Mekarayon team next week. Should be a good match. They have some good players. Baba nodded. You know, I played center forward too when I was young.